Like Linda said, this presentation is about using workers' comp data to describe injuries occurring to workers in the ambulance services industry. In order to give you a sense of what I'm going to present, I'm going to start with a description of what the ambulance services industry is. We'll talk a little bit about the study methods, including some of the data processing details that we use. Then we'll move on to some study results and follow up with some existing prevention recommendations. So the ambulance services industry is defined by NAICS 62191. By definition, this private sector industry provides medical care, both emergency and non-emergency care, it transports patients by ground or air. Their vehicles are equipped with life-saving equipment and operated by medically trained personnel. Now, there's many different occupations within this industry. The two primary are EMTs and paramedics. But this industry also captures nurses, dispatchers, drivers, and administrative staff. I'm sure there's some other small ones that I've left out as well. But the key is the two big ones are the EMTs and the paramedics. So this study is a bit different because a lot of the work that has been done thus far has been very occupation specific, focusing on the EMTs and the paramedics. This one, of course, focuses on industry, so I looked for comparable data, turned to BLS. In 2015, in this industry, there were 10,200 total recordable injuries and illnesses among this industry. 5,900 of those involved days away from work, job transfer or restriction, and 3,700 of those were days away from work. If you're interested about the rates, the bottom for the total, we have 6.8 per 100 FTE, 4.0 per 100 FTE for 5,000 or for the days away from work job transfer restriction, and 2.5 per 100 FTE for the days away from work. So why is it important that we know about injuries that are occurring within this industry? Well, first of all, the EMS services provide a critical public health and safety function. Second, when you look at their demand in the future, it's been projected that from 2014 to 2024, the workforce is going to grow by 24%. This is considered much faster than other occupations. Conversely, obviously, there's injuries that are impacting this workforce. And while this is not the only factor impacting worker retention, it is one of the important ones, and we do need to address it. So our study analyzed data from the Ohio Bureau of Workers' Compensation from 2001 to 2011. And Ohio is one of four states that has an exclusive state-run system. All public and private employers with 500 employees are required to be insured by, with less than 500 employees are required to be insured by OHBWC. Employers with more than 500 employees can self-insure. And it's estimated that OHBWC covers about 67% of the workforce and 99% of the employers in the state. This study was limited to private ambulance services in NAICS 62191. This is a bit different, again, compared to other studies because it's industry-focused versus occupation-based. Consequently, this is going to limit comparisons to previous studies a little bit. Also limiting this study is the fact that it is private services only, so obviously this excludes public services such as fire departments and other governmental services. So in 2011, there was a national EMS assessment of the workforce, and they estimated that the fire department and other government is about 60% of their workforce. The other thing that's going to be missing from this study is hospital-based ambulance services because they obviously would have the hospital code. And the 2011 EMS assessment calculated that at about 6% of the total workforce. The study included both single and multi-location employers. It also included both medical-only and lost-time claims. The medical-only claims are those that have medical treatment expenses only or seven or fewer days loss from work. Lost time claims are those that result in 8 or more days away from work. So from 2001 through 2011, we identified 5,882 claims in the ambulance services. And then we then did additional data coding in preparation. Two-digit OIKS event codes were assigned by an auto-coding program that was designed by the NIOSH Center for Workers' Compensation Studies. The auto codes that were assigned there were then reviewed by two manual coders, and any differences were adjudicated by those two coders. One of the advantages to the workers' comp data is that they have a rich narrative injury description field. And we took advantage of that and did some additional coding. These additional codes were assigned based on injury event groupings. So for overexertion from an outside source, we used a slightly modified version of the injury activity codes that are found in the Occupational Health and Safety Network. And we did this to help better define what the worker really was doing at the time of his or her injury. For falls, motor vehicle events, and violence, we assigned dichotomous codes indicating the presence or absence of contributing factors. And while we appreciate the ability to glean this information from the data, we also recognize that this just produces a lower bound estimate. There's obviously other cases in there that just failed to mention the same contributing factor in the narrative, but at least gives us a starting point and an idea of the lower bound. Additional data preparation involved linking the OHBWC data to the unemployment insurance data in order to estimate full-time employee counts and classify each claim by NAICS code, as we've heard with California. The unemployment insurance data does have some limitations, including some variations in the NAICS codes, occasional missing counts for employment counts for a quarter. So because of this, when we talk about the FTE, we do refer to them as estimated FTE. Linking to unemployment insurance also enabled the calculation of raw claim rates at the policy level in order to identify potential outliers. And for this particular ambulance services project, there were no outliers identified. So of the 5,882 claims, 81% of the claims are medical only and 19% are lost time. The average total rate over the 11-year period was 11.1 per 100 estimated FTE. The average rate for medical only was 9 per 100 estimated FTE, and for lost time claims was 2.1 per 100 estimated FTE. And over the years, you can see there was a downward trend. This is statistically significant, and there's an average annual change of about 3 to 4% for each claim type. So this slide was included to point out that the rate declines over the years are not unique to the ambulance services. So here you can see from the previous slide, I have the ambulance total claim line as well as the ambulance lost time claim line. And then I added the claim lines for all industry totals and all industry lost time. So the total claim rate for all industries dropped from 6.6 to 3.3, and their lost time claim rate dropped from 1.2. 2.6. This also, of course, gives you an idea of how high the rate is for the ambulance services industry. From this point forward, the claims presented on the slides are total claims. They include both the lost time and the medical-only claims, unless it's clearly otherwise specified. The slide gives you a brief overview of the sex and age distributions within the claims. You can see that 54% of the claims were for male workers and 45% were for female workers, and then there's a small sliver of unknown in there. The national workforce is closer to 2/3 male and 1/3 female, so possibly females are slightly overrepresented here. The bar graph gives you the age distribution, and most injuries, as you can see, are in the 25 to 34-year-old age group. Not a big surprise, because this really largely reflects the national distribution of the workforce. They tend to be younger workers. The graph on the left here shows the distribution of total claims by employer size. And as would be expected, a greater number of claims are found among the larger employers. But if we move to the graph on the right that shows total claim rates by employer size, you can see that the rates are somewhat lower among smaller employers, although they're actually about half of what the larger employers are. This could be an issue of exposure in the field, given that smaller agencies are located in more rural areas and they don't get as many calls, thus less field exposure. It could also be an issue of underreporting. We really don't know what it is at this point. So back sprains and strains are the top diagnosis, regardless of whether you're looking at medical-only claims, lost time claims, or all claims. And for each claim type, they represent about 30%. The remaining top diagnoses are arm sprains and strains, contusions, leg sprains and strains, and open wounds. Contusions and open wounds are a little bit unique as they are more common in the medical-only claims. They account for about 10%. They each account for about 10% of medical-only claims, but less than 1% of the lost time claims. The open wound claims are largely related to things like needle sticks and other sharps, such as lancets. Oh, and to give you an idea of what this distribution looks like in comparison with that for all industries, back sprains and strains are just 12% for all industries, while they're 30% here, obviously. Also, all sprains and strains among the ambulance services industry are 60%, but among all industries, they account for only 31%. So this slide shows leading diagnosis for lost time claims, which is the proxy we use to define the claims of greater severity. And you can see that contusions and open wounds obviously disappear from this list and are replaced by the items that are circled in red, disc disorders, and sprains and strains of the neck. This slide shows the distribution of the leading injury events for all claims. Overexertion involving outside sources is the most common injury event, representing nearly half of all claims. Roadway incidents are second at 12%, and this is a bit unusual. We've done a study, there's a couple studies out there. We did one looking at EMS workers treated in emergency departments, and for the most part couldn't even report the roadway incidents. There's also a national study out there looking at injuries related to days away from work, and roadway incidents were third on their list. However, if you were to look at fatal incidents, roadway incidents are obviously there at the top for this group. And the remaining three events here are falls to same-level falls, struck bys, and needle sticks. So again, what happens if we look at the lost time claims only? Overexertion has actually increased a little bit. It's now more than 50% of the claims. Roadway incidents and same-level falls continue to be on there. The last two leading injury events are now fall-related, with slips and trips without a fall and lower-level falls. This chart shows annual claim rates for the top three events by two-digit OIX codes. Overexertion claim rates began at 4.8 in 2001 and dropped to 4.1 in 2011. The roadway incident claims began at 1.4 and dropped to 1 by 2011, and both of these decreases were statistically significant. The falls exhibited little change. They started at 0.6 in 2001 and ended at 0.7 in 2011. This slide details the claims related to overexertion involving outside sources. This is the most common injury event with 2,618 claims at a rate of 5.1 per 100 estimated FTE. Not surprisingly, the diagnoses related to these, about 80% were sprains and strains, with about 50% of these being back sprains and strains. When we looked at the contributing factors to this event, we found that 31% of injury narratives indicated the worker was moving a heavy, overweight, or obese patient at the time of their injury. And of course, as a reminder, this is a lower bound estimate. There's probably many more in the data that just they didn't specify it in the narrative. So among all overexertion claims, we looked at the activity the worker was engaged at the time of the injury, based on the information in the injury narrative, and stretcher transport was represented in 44% of the claims, and this included any movement of the patient while they were on a cot, including lifting and lowering that cot. This is followed by other patient handling activities, lateral transfers, which involved moving a patient from one horizontal surface to another, accounted for 11% of injuries, and transfers where a bed or chair was either the starting or ending point accounted for 7% of the claims. We also had a fair number of claims related to transporting patients in wheelchairs and moving equipment without mention of patient involvement. Motor vehicle incidents were the second leading injury event. 99% of these incidents were roadway incidents. We did throw the few extra non-roadway incidents in here, but the majority are roadway. There were a total of 732 claims at a rate of 1.4 per 100 estimated FTE. About half of these incidents resulted in sprains and strains of the back and neck. And motor vehicle incidents include not only collisions, but also injuries that occur as a result of sudden stops, starts, swerves, jolts, that sort of thing. So we looked at the injury narratives again to pick out the ones that clearly identified collision. 54% of those identified vehicle collision was a factor, with there being 62% of those 62% of the lost time claims identifying vehicle collision and 52% of the medical only. So this chart looks at the distributions of motor vehicle claims by claim type. The distribution of lost time claims was higher among workers of 19 to 99, or employers of 19 to 99 workers, while larger employers sheltered a bigger burden of the medical only claims. Also have noticed that the distribution of medical-only claims seems to be very distinct based on employer size, with a very small percentage of the medical-only claims appearing in the smaller employers. There is actually a similar pattern to this when looking at all injury events. While we don't know the reason behind this, one reason might be that workers in smaller agencies are less likely to report medical only claims or file for workers' compensation. Conversely, as Tish mentioned earlier, the larger companies may have more ability to bring workers back on light duty or job transfers, so they just end up being more medical only claims versus lost time claims. Falls on the same level were the third most common injury event. This slide aggregates the information from all types of falls. There are a total of 779 falls at a rate of 1.5 per 100 estimated FTE. Contusions and leg sprains and strains accounted for almost half of all fall-related diagnoses. Falls on the same level were the most common type of injury, representing nearly 50% of the falls. And it was followed by slips and trips without a fall and falls to a lower level. Just of note, about 40% of the lower level falls were due to exiting an ambulance. So we looked at the injury narratives for falls to identify if any of the contributing factors on this slide were mentioned. And of note, the factors on this slide are not mutually exclusive. The most common factor was having some sort of liquid on the walking surface, with common examples being water, snow, and ice. Almost a quarter of falls occurred while entering or exiting an ambulance. One-fifth occurred while moving a patient, and 14% occurred while going up or downstairs. One last injury event I wanted to cover is violence, because it's getting increasingly more attention in the emergency medical services community. We identified 155 claims at a rate of 0.3 per 100 estimated FTE. And unlike most other injury events where lost time claims represented about a quarter of all claims, for violence they represented only 10%. The most common diagnoses were contusions, sprains and strains of the arm, and superficial injuries. And per our analysis of the injury narrative, 85% of the violent incidents were perpetrated by patients. Another 9% were clearly stated to be perpetrated by someone other than the patient, and then we have had a 6% where it was unclear who the perpetrator really was. And one thing that I do think is important to point out here is that like other injury events, but even more so, this is likely to be an underestimate of violent events. Because they just don't consistently result in workers' compensation claims. In addition to physical harm, there's issues of just mental and emotional harm, and that rarely would constitute an approved workers' comp claim. So this is a quick summary of the study results. Even though the rates are declining, injuries continue to threaten the longevity and the stability of the EMS workforce. And the risk continues to be high when you compare it to all the other industries. overexertion is the most common injury event, and correspondingly, sprains and strains are the most common diagnosis, and they account for about 60% of all claims. About half of those injuries are coming from moving people on stretchers. I should say at least half of those injuries, because again, that's one that came from the injury narrative. The rates are higher among large employers, but lost time claims are more heavily distributed among employers of 99 workers or less. In regards to study limitations, the study was based on workers' compensation data only, and obviously not all injured workers file for workers' compensation. The data were limited to private employers only, and that obviously excludes those employed by fire department and other government agencies. And from an occupation perspective, this obviously only covers a portion of the EMTs and paramedics who perform similar work tasks. And of course, one of the issues of trying to count injuries among healthcare workers is their ability to skirt the medical system by either self-treating or informally seeking treatment from another colleague. So, and also, of course, several studies have pointed to the potential underreporting within workers' compensation data. So what is next? I'm going to share just a few slides about preventing injuries within this workforce, as well from the perspective of the employer as well as the employee. And much of this comes from a publication from the National Association of Emergency Medical Technicians that was titled Promoting Safety in the Workplace. This slide touches on some of the employer responsibilities, which includes establishing a strong safety culture and providing clear safety guidelines. The next bullet suggests the need to evaluate shift scheduling. There's been some recent research that has established a correlation between long shifts, fatigue, and injury risks among this particular worker population. Providing practical and useful safety training is important. Given the two leading events that we found in the workers' comp data, we recommend that they provide training related to patient lifting and moving, as well as emergency vehicle operations. And employers can also explore purchasing improved patient handling equipment. So I will say agencies in Ohio are really fortunate because Ohio has a safety intervention grant that they administer, and these agencies can apply for it and get help with purchasing things such as power cots, power load systems, better stair chairs, and many of the agencies in Ohio have taken advantage of that. Of course, a lot of those are past the study timeline, so we really can't make a connection at this point between the two. So other employer steps towards injury reduction includes considering safety when designing ambulances and ordering equipment. The best practices guide there shown there talks about how to design the patient compartment in order to prevent both worker and patient injuries. The proposed designs in this guide also encourage or enable the worker to remain restrained and still have access to the patient and all the necessary equipment. And this, of course, leads to the next bullet of requiring the use of occupant restraints. EMS workers are getting better with this. They do fairly well in the front compartment, in the patient compartment, not so much. Definitely more work needs to be done there. Also related to motor vehicle safety is prohibiting distracted driving, particularly texting and data input. And finally, in relation to fall prevention, employers can require that their employees wear durable and slip-resistant footwear. From an employee perspective, it is important that they contribute to the safety culture because it's obviously shared between employer and employee. They should be encouraged to communicate and talk with both their partner and their employer about safety concerns. They also need to feel that they can report near misses without having repercussions from their employer. Employees should make sure that they use available resources. This comes up a lot, especially when they're handling heavy equipment or heavy patients. Number one, they should use, if they have patient lifting equipment around, they should try to make use of it. The other thing, though, is if they have colleagues around who can help with the heavy lift, they should ask for assist if time allows. And finally, they should drive safely. So just like, I mean, this obviously includes, again, no distracted driving, but, driving an emergency vehicle is much different than us driving our cars down the road, and they need to periodically reassess how their driving behaviors are when they're in an emergency vehicle and make sure that they update their knowledge for the protection of both the people in the ambulance as well as the general driving public. So this is my list of co-authors, and I just wanted to acknowledge all their help and assistance that they've given in preparing this presentation and the manuscript that we hope to complete here in the next couple months. And NIOSH does have an emergency medical services workers topic page if anyone's interested in more information about EMS workers. And there's my contact information. I'm happy to take questions. Maybe because you're seeing it at an angle, it says something else. Is that
roadway?
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, it's roadway.
Oh, sorry, I'm sorry.
Forget
that question.
Okay. They do have restraints that move with the worker. I am not the engineer part of this, so I actually can't speak to the most recent designs. I just know that the engineers in our division are highly promoting the use of restraints in the back that do allow them to move around, at least to be able to reach the patient and the equipment. So it's not just a lap belt.
It's hard for me to conceptualize what that looks like, but
it's basically a three-point hitch. Whenever you have a shoulder strap, it'll move, but as soon as you put tension on it, it catches. Mm-hmm. And the way they design them is that as a three-point system, once that ambulance makes a sudden stop or a jerk, it'll lock that current. Right. Now, it doesn't necessarily prevent all issues, but it does prevent them from becoming a projectile on the back of the ambulance.
Which is a common problem.
Right.
Great presentation, and I love seeing the prevention recommendations incorporated. So, you know, our claims rate went down with the recession. Did you track this against the recession? Because our claims rates have gone down with the recession,
right.
Which I think is happening in the U.S. too. And so I'm wondering, what, you know what I mean? Do you think this is a real decline, or do we think this may reflect?
Well, I have not looked at it like that yet, but I do know they looked at it for the all industries paper, and they actually divided it because of the recession. I'm looking at Alicia because she was part of that paper.
Yeah, we did two different trend lines, so we looked at the trends from 2001 to 2008, and then 2009 to 2011. But then you also kind of look at just the raw differences between 2008 and 2009. About a 20% decline just in that 1 year, but generally speaking, by 2011, the rates are the same or higher than 2008.
Right, and so, I mean, it was weird. There's like this delayed effect of the recession, and then it seems to be
right.
But, you know, has to do with all these hypotheses about inexperienced workers are laid off and more experienced.
And I do need to look at that a little bit more, but we did look at it initially when we were putting this slide together. And if you look up here, you can see what Alicia's talking about, that how in 2009 it kind of levels off. But the ambulance services were a little bit different, so we need to think about it some more.
Is this declining rate that we're seeing?
Mm-hmm. Is another factor.
I mean, it sounds
yeah,
like they are making some technological advances.
I mean, it definitely looks different.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it doesn't follow the one for all industries. So, I'm not sure. We will continue to think about it, though. Thank you.
Yeah, I was really shocked at how many of the overexertion claims have patients, not in the injury field, but like mm-hmm. if you add up the stretcher moving and the moving from a wheelchair and all of those other moving, it seems like 90 plus percent of them include patients.
Oh, yes.
You know, in California, we have a say patient handling regulation, and
mm-hmm.
we thought about how we could find patient injuries, but we don't have OIST data, so it's more difficult than I want it to not, but it seems like a high amount of these are patient handling.
Well, they're overexertion from an outside source. So the outside source is generally patients. Sometimes it's equipment, but I would say at least 90%.
That's all these guys do. They drive and they handle patients. They don't really do anything else in a hospital. Well, healthcare workers in a hospital do a lot of different things.
Well, they do clean the ambulance, and you know, I get some equipment moving.
So, isn't there a hierarchy that someone's in the stretcher if the patient was, and it's just the stretcher alone? You know, that's what you're saying,
right?
That patient, how do you define patient handling?
Right.
And you're saying there's patient handling, direct patient,
mm-hmm.
and then there's this equipment. But I think there might be a hierarchy.
And admittedly, it's a little murky because we couldn't always make that distinction. So. But just the 71, we only coded it two digits, so the 71 would be either or, would be patient or equipment. So just the OIX code that was assigned was broad, but then when we looked at the contributing factors and the specific injury activities where we were pulling it out of the injury description, then there were cases where we couldn't make that distinction. So we did try to err on the point of being more conservative. If it clearly didn't say patient, we just marked it as equipment.
Place for considering their hours of work and like the number of patients they deal with, because aren't most of the ambulance calls don't result in transporting a patient, where it's only like a third, I don't know what the number is, but and so it seems like if you like that would be a good thing to know, but I don't know.
That would be a wonderful thing to know, but hours worked for EMS is just so hard to. I don't.
What they're doing during the hours.
Yeah. Now I would be inclined to think that these guys in private sector, so we're talking like AMR and AAA and that kind of, that they are doing more transport because they end up the ones that shuffle the patient from the nursing home to the hospital or the nursing home to the doctor's visit. Or, you know, the fire department though, those agencies I think are more like what you're describing. They get called out and they're like, yeah, you're fine. I don't know, that's just my inclination. I do think they end up doing more transport though. Mm-hmm.
Well, you could say that certain hospital-based EMS
Well, I didn't exclude them. They get excluded just on the basis of the NAICS code. So they would have a... Right, so they would have it, yeah. So again, that's a small percentage. That's about 6% of the EMS workforce. Yes?
It just occurred to me that one of the reasons why you may see more motor vehicle incidents in this group is because they are actively doing calls. Whereas if you send a police, if you send a fire department
mm-hmm.
There's no hurry for them to get someplace, to get back to the firehouse.
Mm-hmm.
So they may not be driving with the same kind of issues that someone that's constantly making a call and has a patient in the back.
Right, and that goes back to the whole issue that Linda was touching on, is the hours of exposure. I mean, it would be so wonderful if we could know that, but I think the EMS community has been saying that for years and hasn't figured out a way to capture that yet. Anything else?